Another transducer that can be used to measure the angular velocity in the rotation of an object is the so-called tachometric alternator. It is very similar to the tachometric dynamo. Even in this case, we have a C-shaped ferromagnetic nucleus and a rotor, again made up by ferromagnetic material. But in this case, the permanent magnet is the rotor, not the nucleus. The nucleus is only the rod that transports the flux lines relative to the magnetic field present into the system. This means that we can still measure high velocities, but all the energies that are present in such a kind of system are considerably lower with respect to the case of the tachometric dynamo, and this means that the output could need an operational amplifier. Also, the dimensions of the transducer can be smaller or considerably smaller with respect to those that characterize the dynamo, and this characteristic makes this kind of transducer suitable for measurements in embedded applications or where the low power consumption could be an important process constraint. The permanent magnet is shaped like, let's say, a dipole. So it is a vertical rod with two poles at the extremities and rotates on a shaft that is connected to the rotating object under measurement. In the nucleus, we have a solenoid, and we measure the voltage or the voltage variation present at the extremities. The permanent magnet given in the center of of the structure of the transducer is characterized by a magnetic field whose flux is variable due to the rotor movement. This creates the conditions for applying the Faraday-Neumann law. So we can say that the flux goes with the cosine of the angular velocity. Phi is equal to phi zero, the amplitude, times the cosine omega t. The function that we used is the cosine because we understand that the best alignment of the rotor is the horizontal one, and in this case the maximum flux lines will cross the nucleus expansions and will couple with the coils of the solenoid, so inducing in that circuit a suitable electromotive force. Instead, the coupling of the flux lines with the magnetic circuit is minimum when the rotor is vertical. So we have a function that depends on the orientation of the rotor, of the rod, and is maximum when the angular position is zero, and it is minimum when the angular position is 90 degrees. That is, it goes with the cosine function. If we apply to this definition the Faraday-Neumann law, that is, if we evaluate the derivative function of the flux with respect to the time, we will have that this cosine will be transformed into the sine function, and the inducted electromotive force into the coils of the solenoid will be expressed by N omega phi sine of omega t. N is the number of the coils involved in such a kind of induction, that is the number of the coils that constitute the solenoid. The problem of this electromotive force is the double dependence on the angular rotation velocity that is present both into the amplitude and into the sinusoidal waveform term. Moreover, as we know, this term depends in turn even on the time. So we have two possibilities. The first is to transform this signal into a continuum signal into which the output is only the amplitude, and measuring the voltage we have a direct information concerning the angular velocity. This is done through an electronic network called rectifier, or otherwise we can transform the sinusoidal waveform into a sequence of pulses that can be counted by a suitable counter or acquired by the microprocessor. And if we consider the number of these pulses related to a well-known interval, the ratio between the two quantities will give an estimation of the oscillation frequency of the sine function, that is an estimation of the omega term. The transformation of the signal into a sequence of pulses can be performed through an operational amplifier playing as a comparator that performs the comparison between the waveform, the sine waveform, with a fixed threshold that could be, for example, zero if the sinusoidal waveform oscillates around this value. We can choose one solution or the other. Let's consider that if the frequency is high, that is, if omega t is particularly important, the electronic circuits could be, let's say, at the limit of their own performances. So in this case, we could use an operational amplifier that typically has a cutoff frequency that is higher in frequency. Instead, for medium-low values of the rotation velocity, we can use a rectifier that features in its own electronic chain a low-pass filter. And this is the main reason why we cannot consider it for measuring the voltage at high frequencies. Generally speaking, the information is considered associated to the frequency of the emitted signal exactly for this reason, because typically this tachometric alternator, due to its small dimensions and to the fact that it is very light, since it is small, can provide us the measurement of very high rotation velocities. Concerning the output, we have two possible ways to measure the e-voltage. The first is to supply a voltage to the solenoid, solenoidal circuit, and to measure the variation into this voltage due to the coupling effect of the magnetic field and the induced voltage in the coils of the solenoidal circuit. The other one is only to measure the voltage that takes origin in the solenoidal circuit itself without providing any kind of power supply. Another kind of transducer to measure the rotation velocity is the so-called induction-based generator. Like the tachometer dynamo is the corresponding of the direct current motor, even in this case we can establish a correspondence with such a kind of transducer together with the current generator induction based. In those devices the output will be the angular velocity of a shaft controlled on the basis of a suitable couple of current power supplied electronic circuits. In this case, instead, we have a couple of stators circuits and a rotor that induced currents based on electromagnetic coupling effects and obtain a final voltage that is proportional to the rotation of the rotor itself. This is to say that due to the size of this device, due to the fact that it is possible to mount a very big shaft on which the rotating object can be connected, this is a typical transducer able to measure high velocities of very heavy objects due to also the fact that we can size the stator 1 and the stator 2 as large as we want to support very high currents crossing them. In other words, this is not a typical device for embedded applications, but can be considered a device that measures rotation velocities in very, very complex, big, and also power-consuming processes, for example, on ships or very, very big moving devices. The generator is also called as a squirrel cage because we have basically two conductive circles, as you can see in the figure in slide 33 in the upper left part of the slide. We have two conducting circles connected by a series of very thin conductive rods. This is the rotor of the device. In the center of the rotor we have an axis that is a shaft to which the object under measurement is applied. In the right lower part of the slide, we see a frontal view of the device into which the rotor is colored in green. All those black points represent the connections between every circular edge under the rods. And we see that the rotor is located under a suitable solenoid, AC power supplied, and is corresponding to another solenoidal circuit that is called stator 2, while the previous one is called stator 1. The second stator is not supplied because we measure, typically, the voltage induced by the rotation of the rotor that in turn is characterized by coupling effects with respect a magnetic field that arrives from stator 1. Just to go into the details and to clarify how this device works, we can see those yellow dotted lines that represent the magnetic field generated by the first stator. These lines represent the flux due to the fact that the stator 1 is supplied in AC voltage, so we are in the conditions to apply the Biot-Savart law that says that when a coil is crossed by a current variable in the time, a magnetic field oriented toward the vertical axis perpendicular to the surface of the coil itself is generated. And in this case we have a solenoidal circuit that is made by many coils. The flux lines will irradiate the green rotor, and as we can see in a minute, we can identify, we can, let's say, isolate many coils even in the green rotor. So each one of those coils will be the site of an induced voltage that in turn will generate a new magnetic field, some components of which are able to couple with the horizontal statoric circuit number 2. And this means that even in this case we are in the conditions of measuring induced voltages in such a kind of statoric circuit, and when the green rotor will rotate clockwise or counterclockwise, we will be able to measure both the intensity of the rotation and the direction into which this takes place. To better understand how this kind of generator works, let's go to slide 34 and let's consider the cylindric structure of the transducer. We have the two circles, green circles, and we have highlighted some rods connecting suitable points, identifying on the surface of each circle. Namely, they are A, B, C, D, and the correspondent one, A prime, B prime, C prime, and D prime. We have also draw in the picture the rods that connect A and A prime, B and B prime, C and C prime, and D and D prime. Now let's consider these points and the correspondent relative electronic circuits from a particular point of view. That is, if we go from A to A prime, from A prime to B prime, from B prime we come back to B and then to A, we have identified a closed area limited by wires that are conductive things, conductive materials, and in such a way can be considered as a coil, a particular kind of coil, because typically for us coils are circular. In this case the general shape is not circular, we could define it as a spherical cap. We highlighted this kind of spherical cap in the middle of the figure in slide 34. We indicated it just to simplify AB, and we can do the same geometrical approach, considering now the points C, C prime, D, D prime. In other words, we go from C to C prime running along the wire that connects these two points. Then we run in the border of the green circular edge of the transducer from C prime up to D prime, and then we come back to D from D prime again, running along the corresponding road that joins these two points, and finally we go back to the starting point of this run of this road, remaining in the border of the circular surface DC. We have defined in such a way another spherical cap, another let's say coil, that is indicated again better in a more clear, in a more understandable way in the middle of the figure, is indicated as spherical cap CD. The two surfaces, the two coils, have been taken in a symmetric way. That is, if you join more or less A and B with a line under CD, you will see that the two lines are crossing, describe an X. If we look the cylindric device from a frontal point of view. Moreover, if we stretch these two spherical caps, we will have two parallelogram shaped coils that, as I said before, mutually cross. They are indicated by the two yellow, let's say, figures in the right part of the picture in slide 34. Consider that these two coils are irradiated by the magnetic field coming from the statoric circuit number 1, in particular by their flux lines, so they will be sight of an induced voltage both in the coil AB and in the coil CD. Doing this represents an approximation. We are introducing a small mistake in the evaluation of the velocity because clearly the irradiation depends on the amplitude of the surface irradiated, but also on its shape. To consider a plane surface, like in the last case, instead of a curvilinear surface, like really it is an error because we lose, let's say, the coefficient of efficiency that depends on the curvature of the surface we have identified. Clearly, like an umbrella, the irradiation will be higher if the umbrella is open, instead will be a little bit less if the umbrella is partially open, and will be negligible if the umbrella is closed. By stretching the two surfaces AB and CD, basically we have made the hypothesis that the umbrella is completely open. But this is not a great mistake. Let's now go to slide 35 that show us what is the induction effect due to the mutual crossing of the two coils, considering, however, the situation into which the rotor is stopped. It doesn't move. We see two dotted lines because we are in a particular point of view that is frontal to the cylindric structure of the transducer itself. So from this point of view, we see the edges of the two parallelograms we have identified as simply lines dotted, in this case, AB and CD. And you can appreciate how they cross reciprocally, and what I said before, that they describe, let's say, an X letter due to their mutual crossing. B is the magnetic field caused by the statoric circuit number 1, that is power supplied, directed towards the down direction. And you see two red arrows that correspond to the magnetic fields caused, originated in the two AB and CD coils. In fact, the flux lines of the B magnetic field will irradiate the two coils. So every coil will feature an induced voltage, and this induced voltage will in turn generate a magnetic field, exactly following what the Faraday-Neumann law says, that is, the electromotive induced force will be the variation of the flux in the time, and we have a flux that varies in the time because the statoric circuit number 1 is alternate power supplied. Then we will have an electromotive force that in turn is variable in time. And this allows us to apply the same law in the reverse sense, that is, this voltage will create a magnetic field whose direction is perpendicular to the surface of the coil, and the two red arrows are perpendicular to the two dotted lines, and the direction is determined by the sign of the Faraday-Neumann law. If you remember, that law says the electromotive force is equal to minus the derivative function of the flux in the time. That minus has a precise significance. It claims that the electromotive induced voltage will cause an action that is opposing to the cause that originates itself. This means that since the B magnetic field from the statoric circuit number 1 goes downwards, the direction of the two magnetic fields BAB and BCD will be directed upwards, respecting the other constraint that says that they must have to be they must be oriented perpendicular to the surface of the two coils. This is the situation if the rotor is not moving, so the resulting magnetic field that we have by adding the two red magnetic fields, the two BACD and BAB magnetic fields, is the blue resulting one that is exactly in the opposite direction with respect to the origin, with respect to the magnetic field of the stator number 1. And this is the situation without any rotation. Now, let's suppose that the cage rotates clockwise, and let's go to the slide 36. In this case, we have a new particular effect. The B magnetic field is always directed downwards. Due to the rotation, if you look at the figure, the rotation is well shown by the yellow arrow. So the rotation is, let's say, from right to left. The two coils will feature a different behavior. While the coil AB becomes more vertical, the coil CD will become more horizontal. This means that AB will feature a decrease, a decrement in the irradiation of the B magnetic field, while the coil CD will feature an increment in the irradiation because it will become more exposed, more horizontal. The variation of the flux will be negative in the first case, the irradiation diminishes, and positive in the second case, the irradiation is increasing. Remember that the Faraday-Neumann produces an inducted voltage that is proportional to the variation of the flux, with a minus sign added. That is, the new magnetic field of the coil BCD will be directed upwards, towards the high direction, because basically it has to oppose to the variation caused by the rotation, and in this case the variation is augmenting the irradiation, that is, augmenting the flux. So the opposition is to bring a new component directed against this variation. But in the case of the coil AB, the variation is negative because AB will be less exposed to the irradiation. So the derivative function of the flux will be negative. With the minus sign, we will have an inducted voltage positive who will produce a magnetic field that helps the irradiation, since the movement of the coil diminishes this irradiation. Summarizing all these considerations, the direction of the magnetic field in the coil AB is directed to downwards. Now the situation is different, and if we compose the two magnetic fields, we have that blue arrow that is horizontal and is very well coupling with the statoric circuit number 2, into which we will have, due to this magnetic field, an inducted voltage that is proportional to the phenomenon that originated the magnetic field with the blue arrow, that is the rotation of the rotor itself. Consider that in case of counterclockwise rotation, the situation is opposite, because in this case the coil CD will become more vertical, and while the coil AB will become more horizontal. So the direction of the induced magnetic field will be opposite, and opposite will be also the direction of the blue resulting magnetic field. This will induce in the stator number 2 an inducted voltage that will have a phase opposite in this case. So we are able also to recognize in this case the direction on which the rotor is basing its movement. When I say that the induced voltage is opposed in phase, I mean that this opposition of phase is with respect the primary cause of all this chain of phenomenon. That is the signal E of T, the alternate current with which we power supplied the statoric circuit number one. Clearly, the situation that we have described represents an example just to learn what is happening inside this kind of transducer. But we have to consider that the real situation and the real phenomenon is the superposition of several phenomena like this one. First of all, we have chosen two coils, AB and CD, crossing due to the symmetry with which we have identified the AB and the CD points. But we can subdivide the rotor, the squirrel cage, in several coils like these ones. For each one of these couple of coils, induced voltage into the statoric circuit number 2 can be identified. So the final voltage that is present in that circuit will be the sum of all the contributes of the coils that we can identify. Each one of them, indeed, is corresponding to the B magnetic field colored in blue that we are looking at in the slide 36. That magnetic field will cause, will induce, will originate a voltage into the stator number 2. We didn't demonstrate the dependence of that voltage on the rotation of the rotor and in such a way on the angular velocity, because the formulas would have been very complicated and far from the scope of this course. But we can again make a very, let's say, inductive, we could say, consideration about what is happening for one of these magnetic fields, well knowing that what we are saying will be valid also for all the other ones. If you look at the current direction of the magnetic field, you see that in this moment, in this phase, due to the rotation of the rotor, it can be considered perfectly horizontal. And in such a way, the coupling with the direction of the stator number 2 is perfect. So its capability of inducting a voltage inside it is the maximum possible. The efficiency is the best one. But at the same time, we know that due to the rotation of the rotor, those coils AB and CD will change their own mutual position, and this will cause a new magnetic field resulting, because even BCD and BAB will change their amplitude and their orientation. Generally speaking, this resulting magnetic field will not perfectly oriented in the same way as the stator number 2. And during the overall rotation of the couple of the coils, the magnetic field represented in blue into the picture will rotate itself according to this movement. So we can say that when the direction will be perfectly vertical, as we said when the rotor was fixed, was stopped, the coupling will be very poor and no voltage induced will be present in the stator number 2. And when due to the rotation, the magnetic field will be again perfectly horizontal, but with a direction opposite with respect to the present one, we will have an inducted voltage in the stator number 2 with an opposite sign compared to now. And again, when the B magnetic field, the B in blue, I mean, magnetic field will be oriented vertically, but with the arrow downward oriented, again the coupling will be completely neglectable, up to come back again due to the rotation oriented in such a way. So we can say that the capability of inducting voltages, considering only this component, this resulting magnetic field, depends on the rotation with a cosinusoidal law, because the maximum coupling is when the direction is horizontal and the minimum when the direction is vertical. This means that the inducted voltage is amplitude time the cosine of the angular rotation time t. If we would better go into the details, we would see that in the amplitude of this induced voltage, the omega will be even present. So we are more or less in the same situations that we have seen in other transducers, and we will conclude that again we will need a synchronous rectifier to eliminate the dependence in this induced voltage on the sinusoidal waveform. Or otherwise, in case of high rotation velocities, we can put the output of the stator number 2 into a comparator and transforming the peaks of the sinusoidal waveforms in pulses that can be counted by a counter read by a microprocessor. But in this case, this is not the usual way, because the objects that are typically connected to the shaft of such a kind of generator are very big, and their inertia is considerable, so we will have velocities that will be not particularly high. And in this case, the usage of an electronic circuit like a synchronous rectifier will be certainly more precise and more affordable. Of course, as we have said several times, all these considerations we did for the only magnetic field represented in the picture, that is the resulting magnetic field of the couple of coils AB and CD, can be repeated for all the coils that can be identified, isolated before and identified after in the overall squirrel cage generator. So what we have said here is valid also for them, but the point is that the voltage in the stator number 2 will be the sum of all these effects. The kind of transducer that is able to measure the angular rotation velocity is the so-called capacitive charge discharge transducer. In this case, we leave the alternate power supply. We use only RC, a low pass, we could say, circuit. No cages, no magnetic coupling phenomenon. So we come back, let's say, to small sizes and small power consumption. In other words, this is another kind of transducer that can be employed in embedded applications, we can apply to the shaft connected to the moving, to the mobile part of the transducer, light objects. Otherwise, the capability of the transducer to follow the rotation is not assured. In this case, we can measure even appreciable velocities. Otherwise, the range of the velocities that can be measured is very restricted, and basically corresponds to very low values. The transducer is consisting of a rotating capacitor that alternatively comes in contact with the power supply E, continuum, typically power supply, with the ground, or with another point connected to the ground, or with the output line that is called U. In this case, the capacitor will be in parallel with a suitable resistor R. Due to the rotation, the edges of the capacitor will be in contact with the power supply, the resistor, the ground, two times for every rotation. In other words, if you look, if you imagine a possible 360 degrees rotation, you will have that one of the edges of the capacitor will contact the power supply, then the resistor, then the ground itself, and then it will come back in contact with the original power supply, the original point from which it started. But during the rotation, the contact, for example, with the power supply is twice, because also the other edge follows the same rule. So we justified the picture that is shown in the lower right part of the slide, into which we see two peaks signal that correspond to the very quick charge of the capacitor to the E value, and then to the discharging phase that, as typically happens in RC circuits, evolves with a time constant that is given by the product of the resistor times the capacitor. From the physics law, we know that typically the time necessary for discharging almost completely a capacitor is equal to 4-5 times the product of the resistor times the capacitor. Of course, this corresponds to a limit in the rotation velocities that such a kind of circuit is able to measure. Moreover, this quantity, 4-5 RC, must be lower than the time into which the next peak will arrive, otherwise the discharging will be not completed. As a general rule, the choice is to fix that this interval, 4-5 times RC, must be less than half of the time that is comprised from one peak to the next one. And since in every rotation, that is in every period, we have that two peaks must be considered, the distance in time between two peaks is half the period, t on 2. So the constraint is that 4-5 RC must be lower than t half. And clearly, this obliges us to correctly estimate the value of the resistor and of the capacitor due the constraint of a certain velocity, a certain rotation velocity that we want to measure to make the transducer to really work properly. Consider, of course, that T, the period of the rotation, is related to the angular velocity, since T is the inverse of the rotation frequency. To perform the measurement from a microprocessor, we can use two possible solutions. The first one is a so-called frequency meter, typically used for high frequencies, that is, high velocities. This approach has been already seen in the past with other transducers like this, and is based on the usage of an amplifier, an operational amplifier, that acts like a comparator, and we insert, we send the output of the capacitive transducer to one of the input pin of the operational amplifier, while the other one is set to a suitable threshold. Acting like a comparator, the output of the operational amplifier will be a pulse train with a period that is equal to the one of the capacitive transducer. Of course, we have to choose the threshold comparable to the one, the baseline of the output signal we are seeing in the slide 37. Clearly, if we choose something that is different, the measurement of the period could be exactly not the same. If this is done, the pulse train in the output of the comparator can be sent to a counter, and the microprocessor could read the counter on a sample by sample basis, every time interval instance of time, not because the microprocessor is not able to follow the frequency of the pulses, but because we want to use the microprocessor also for other purposes. And this could be an acceptable measurement, particularly necessary when the rotation velocity, that is the frequency of the pulses, is very high. As an alternative, we can connect the output of the capacitive transducer to a low-pass filter like the one shown in figure 38. It is convenient to separate the two circuits, the transducer and the low-pass filter, through a buffer, again for the motivation that we have already expressed in the case of the wire-wound potentiometer. The output impedance for the capacitive transducer is the parallel between C and R. If we connect this capacitor C and R directly with the R prime and the C prime circuit, clearly the conditions relative to the impedance values are different. Instead, as we well know, an operational amplifier in buffer configuration separates the impedances before it from those of the circuits that will follow it. The low-pass filter that we are introducing in such a case, R prime, C prime, needs to have a constant product R times C, R prime times C prime, that must be very greater than the period of the pulses T on T half, T on 2. This allows to consider the transfer function of the low-pass filter as an approximated integral function. We know that in the domain of the frequencies in the Laplace domain, the transfer function is 1 divided by 1 plus s r prime c prime. S is the frequency in the Laplace domain. If r prime c prime are very big, s r prime c prime is greater than 1, so 1 on s r prime c prime is the approximated transfer function of such a circuit, that is more or less an integral function. An integral function with r prime c prime that can be considered very large, theoretically infinite even, also it isn't. And an integral function divided by an infinite interval of time corresponds to the definition of the average function we had in mathematics. Moreover, the average function of a periodic signal is the average calculated in the period. So if we calculate the average of the voltage signal provided by the sequence of the pulses we have seen in the slide before, we will have that this output voltage will be 2 times the product of the power supply E time RC divided by the period. In other words, this voltage will be directly proportional to F, that is related to the angular velocity. In other words, we can say that we have found a very simple, very low power consuming circuit whose answer is completely linear and whose sensibility can be modified by acting on the power supply E and on the entity of the electronic parameters featuring in the circuit. Notice that if the rotation is, for example, clockwise, we will have a particular sign in output, for example positive, depending on the connection chosen, while instead if the rotation is inverted, the sign will be the opposite. So in case of using the previous solution, that is the comparator and the counter unit, we will need a reversible counter to perform such a kind of measurement, that is a counter that increases its own value when it has a certain kind of let's say positive pulses, or decrease it when the positive pulses corresponds to the opposite rotation. And this implies that between the comparator and the counter itself, other electronic circuits should be inserted to manage this possibility. Of course, the counter will need an up and down input pins to perform the differentiation in the two set of pulses that will influence the final counting value that the device will bring to the microprocessor itself. We deal now with a completely new measurement and a set of transducers that are devoted to the evaluation of the acceleration of an object that is moving along an axis, along a linear direction. One could think that the acceleration could be obtained by the derivative function of the velocity. We have seen just now a set of angular velocity transducers or one linear velocity transducer, or even through the double derivative function of the outputs provided by the several position transducers that we have seen. But the same considerations we did in the past relating related to the fact that the noise components in the output signals will be increased, will be augmented, since to perform the derivation function corresponds to multiply the signal by s if we are considering velocity, or even by s square if we are considering position, and even the noise will be multiplied by the same quantities. These considerations suggests us that such a kind of operation, that in any case it is possible to be performed on a microprocessor, it should be considered as the last possible choice. But since the electronic technology provides us very efficient acceleration transducers, this is typically the preferred choice made by the engineers. Sometimes, however, single and double integration of the acceleration measured to achieve a position and velocity is in any case required. I have in mind, for example, an application into which we considered a ship moving into the space, and we measured its own acceleration with the aim to calculate the trajectory performed, considering that the movement was with uniform acceleration. In that case, we have no other possibility of different than performing the double integration. We know that it is very critical at low frequencies, but the usage of a very expensive hardware in such a kind of application really motivated could provide enough accuracy as required. The benefit provided by the measurement of the acceleration is that since the acceleration is the same in every reference system that we can consider, we don't need a circuit that refers the measurement to a fixed reference point, but we can in many cases perform the measurement directly on board the object that is moving. Imagine, for example, a car that is moving along a road. Typical transducers are connected to a fixed origin point, and clearly in such a case, in every time such kind of movements are considered, this could be a very hard constraint, a very hard trouble that would make impossible the measurement. The acceleration allowed to perform the measurement directly into the object that is moving, and this clearly solves any kind of problems in such conditions.